Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Heart of the Matter. Last week, we aired part one of a three-part series, which I asked Reverend Ivan Foster to produce for the Heart of the Matter. The title of this series is A History of Ireland as it relates to the Ulster Scots. Now, if you've not heard last week's program yet, I would urge you to listen to it before you listen to this week's message, so you get this history in right order, right chronological order. Now, without further ado, we're going to go right to Reverend Ivan Foster and part two of A History of Ireland as it relates to the Ulster Scots.
While Ireland's Protestantism reeled under the terrible aftermath of the Roman Catholic-inspired rebellion of 1641, in England, the result of the Civil War, which stretched from 1642 to 1651 through its various stages, was the short-lived Commonwealth of England, 1649 to 1653, under Oliver Cromwell. He has been much maligned, but that man of God most certainly did much to bring in parliamentary democracy to the United Kingdom. The Commonwealth was replaced by the Protectorate, 1653 to 1659, which was in fact personal rule by Oliver Cromwell. It was in this historic epoch that the solemn league and covenant between England and Scotland was agreed upon in 1643. It committed both countries to the maintenance of the reformed religion in Scotland and the reformation of religion in England and Ireland, according to the Word of God. It also set forth the extirpation of popery and prelacy, and whatever shall be found to be contrary to sound doctrine and the power of godliness. It was a most momentous document, and must surely be seen as an apex in the development of national religion in the British Isles. As well as introducing parliamentary democracy to the United Kingdom, Oliver Cromwell brought relief to the suffering Protestant people of Ireland by his armed intervention. Ireland had known nothing but war since the rebellion of 1641, with most of the island controlled by the Irish Confederates. These Confederates had entered an alliance with the English Royalists, loyal to the Stuart monarchy, because they felt increasingly threatened by the armies of the English Parliament after Charles I's arrest in 1648. The Confederates signed a treaty of alliance with the English Royalists, and the joint Royalist and Confederate forces under the Duke of Ormond attempted to eliminate the parliamentary army that occupied Dublin, but they were routed at the Battle of Rathmines on the outskirts of Dublin on the 2nd of August 1649. Cromwell naturally had an affinity with the suffering Protestants of Ireland and landed with an army at Dublin on the 15th of August 1649 and set out to quell the armed resistance of the Royalist Irish Rebel Alliance. Cromwell's suppression of the rebels and Royalists during 1649 evokes strong reaction still amongst Roman Catholics in Ireland, and that particularly because of the actions of the English army at Drogheda in September 1649. The putting to death of nearly 3,500 people, comprising around 2,700 Royalist soldiers, mostly Englishmen, and 700 others, including civilians, prisoners, and Roman Catholic priests, all of whom were claimed to be carrying arms and therefore armed insurrectionists. The customary warning had been issued to the city that if it did not surrender, then all would suffer death. Such were the terms of war in the 17th century. The parliamentary conquest of Ireland ground on for another 4 years until 1653, when the last Irish Confederate and Royalist troops surrendered. The victors confiscated almost all Irish Roman Catholic owned land in the wake of the conquest and distributed it to the Parliament's creditors, to the parliamentary soldiers who served in Ireland, and to English people who had settled there before the war. Such are the consequences of war. In the wise providence of God, the Protectorate did not last long and was overthrown shortly after Cromwell's death in September 1658. Political chaos followed in England. His successor as Lord Protector, his son Richard, was not able to manage the Parliament he summoned in 1659 or the army leaders on whose support he relied. He was forced to resign and thereby to abolish the Protectorate in May 1659. In the end, the people really had had enough of military rule and were calling for a new parliament. The assurances of Charles II, the late king's exiled heir, that he would submit to any settlement decided by Parliament convinced the political leadership in May 1660 to invite Charles II to return to claim his father's throne. Whatever hopes some might have had for peace and tranquillity in the nation were doomed. The parliaments of Charles II and his successor, his brother James, were soon to be as turbulent as those of their father. Under Charles II and later James II, it was soon evident that whatever had changed the gospel-hating heart of the Stuart royal family had not. Charles II's profession of regard for Presbyterianism was soon forgotten. Prelacy was reinstated and bishops appointed in Irish dioceses. Meetings of presbytery were prohibited and troops of cavalry were sent to scatter any attempts to hold them. In Ballymena, troops broke up an attempt to convene a meeting of synod. Moreover, Presbyterian ministers had to submit to the prayer book and conform to prelacy or be turned out of their homes. The famed Jeremiah Taylor, Bishop of Down and Connor, was to the fore in this persecution. Ministers were ejected from their pulpits and forbidden, under heavy penalties, to preach. It is to their honour that only 7 ministers were prepared to seek immunity from such penalties, whereas 61 made their choice to suffer rather than sacrifice the truth of God. This happened in 1661. A similar persecuting spirit swept Scotland and England, although not until the next year, 1662, when in England 2,500 ministers were ejected from the Church of England for non-conformity. The 19th century Bishop of Liverpool, J.C. Ryle, referred to this ejection as an injury to the cause of true religion in England, which will probably never be repaired. How wise those words were. When the Protestant populations of England and Ireland are compared at this time, the bold faithfulness of 61 Presbyterians compares most favourably with that of their 2,500 English counterparts. Congregations in Bangor, Newton Ards, Portaferry, Cumber, Castlereagh, Colinshay, Saintfield, Dromore, Rathryland, Omagh, and many, many other places lost their ministers. The spirit of Jenny Geddes of Edinburgh was at work at this time, for the Episcopalian successor of the ousted Presbyterian minister in Cumber, County Down, was pulled from his pulpit by some womenfolk and his surplice torn to pieces. They were tried at the next sitting of Downpatrick Assizes for this offence, but showed no compunction for acting so. If it's not too late for me to say, well done, ladies. In Scotland, of course, the Presbyterian Covenanter movement, based largely in the southwest of the country, was harried by the forces of Charles II and later James II also. It was an important episode in the martyrology of the Church of Scotland, as in Ireland, for there was a close parallel. Episcopalianism was reintroduced to the Church of Scotland, and Presbyterian church ministers were confronted with a stark choice: accept the new situation or lose their livings. Although most conformed, up to a third of the ministry refused. Some of the ministers also took to preaching in the open fields, in conventicles, often attracting thousands of worshippers. Among their objections, these ministers would not take the oath of supremacy because they could not, in conscience, allow any king or head of the church but Jesus Christ. For both Ireland and Scotland and England, the closing years of the 17th century were years of toil, hardship, and blood. But the Lord, as he heard the cry of Israel under the lash of the Egyptians, heard the cries of his people in the three kingdoms. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. Exodus chapter 3 and the verse 7. In a wonderfully reminiscent way, for the Lord's ways change not. Hallelujah. God wrought deliverance in the British Isles, and the site of the decisive events was Ireland. King Charles II died in 1685. Surely his death must have caused many people to hope that change would ensue for the poor suffering saints of Christ's Kirk. But it was not to be. Charles' brother, James II, was not long in possession of the sceptre until he showed that he was intent upon Romanizing the national religion of England, Scotland, and Ireland. In Ireland in particular, James's Romanizing steps were seen. The supreme authority was placed in the hands of Lord Tyrconnell, or Lying Dick Talbot, as he was colloquially known. Protestant judges were deposed and replaced by Romanists. The Irish army was Romanized. Protestant officers and soldiers ousted. The Lord Chancellor and the Attorney General offices were filled by Romanists. This and many other such changes heralded the deepening darkness that Romanist ascendancy would bring. But Providence took a hand, and that in a most unusual manner. An anonymous letter addressed to the Earl of Mount Alexander, who lived near Cumber in County Down, was found lying in the street of Cumber one day in December 1688. On being taken to the Earl and read by him, it was discovered to be an ill-written letter warning that a general massacre of Protestants was planned for December the 9th. Copies of the letter were circulated throughout Ulster and further afield. One such copy arrived at Londonderry on December the 7th. By a curious coincidence, news of the approach of a regiment of Roman Catholic soldiers under the command of Lord Antrim had also arrived. The 9th of December was but 2 days away. What was to be done? Discussions were still taking place when the alarm was sounded that the regiment was approaching and the two officers were at the gates of the city demanding entrance. The Reverend James Gordon of Glendermot Presbyterian Church was in the city, and he gave his opinion, shut the gates and keep them out. The Episcopalian Bishop Ezekiel Hopkins was, as might be expected, of another mind. They were the king's men, and the king must be obeyed, he pontificated. However, God has his men in such an hour when lesser men debate and dally. 8 or 9 young apprentices took it upon themselves to run to the gates and shut and lock them in the face of the regiment and raise the drawbridge. In all, 13 apprentices engaged in this defiant act, which proved to be the salvation of Protestantism not only in Ireland but in England and Scotland as well. The Reverend James Gordon's bold advice had been wisely taken. The ensuing siege, which did not begin in earnest until April 18th, 1689, lasted until the 28th of July, 1689. The city had endured a siege of some 105 days, in which it is estimated that 8,000 of the population of 30,000 died. The persecution of Protestantism ended, thankfully, with the ascension of William, the decisive battle that settled the throne of England, Scotland, and Ireland, and the spiritual destiny of that land for centuries was fought out between King William III and King James II on the banks of the River Boyne on July 1st, 1690. William was victorious, and James fled. There can be no doubt that the bravery and the fidelity of the Protestant people of Ireland, and Ulster in particular, played a major part in that wonderful deliverance for the United Kingdom. Little wonder the cries that echo back to the maiden city of Londonderry and the Boyne, "No surrender," and "Remember 1690," are still heard on the lips of those who bless God for his mercies to our forefathers in times long ago. The 17th century had been one of great turbulence and upheaval throughout the whole of the British Isles, nowhere more so than Ireland. The 18th century was to be characterised by a calmer appearance, though an evil force was at work amongst the people of God, no less destructive, indeed maybe much more so, than persecution, war and violence. In the early part of the 1700s, evangelicalism flourished, and records show that in Ulster, though still sparsely inhabited, yet on the Lord's Day congregations of 600 to 700 could be seen assembling for worship in Presbyterian churches. Some congregations had even larger gatherings. It was not so in the Episcopalian churches. There, small handfuls of people gathered, oftentimes as few as 6 to 7 people. It was little wonder that episcopacy harboured deep resentment against Presbyterianism in such circumstances. In 1703, the first signs of a baleful heresy manifested itself. The Reverend Thomas Emlyn of Wood Street Presbyterian Church in Dublin was deposed because of his Arianism. Arianism has its origins in the teaching of Arius, an Egyptian who lived from AD 250 to 336. He taught that Christ, the Son of God, did not always exist, but was created by God, and is therefore distinct from and a subordinate entity to God the Father. Arius was pronounced a heretic. This wicked attack upon the person of Christ was to feature large later in the century, and indeed in the following century, and cause much harm to the cause of Christ and trouble and grief within the ranks of Presbyterianism. In 1704 there was introduced the Test Act. William of Orange had died in 1702 and his wife's sister Anne was on the throne. She favoured Episcopalianism. The Test Act required that anyone holding a public appointment must take communion in an Episcopal church within 3 months after their appointment or lose their office. It was a particularly cruel law, given the service that Presbyterians had rendered in Ireland in order to bring about the ascension of William and Mary to the throne. Whatever hopes Episcopalianism had of strengthening its ranks by this means were soon disappointed, for the allegiance of those who had come through such trials of fire and sword but a short time before was not so weak as to be swayed by financial considerations. Despite the dire consequences of refusal, refusal was chosen by many Presbyterians rather than the selling of the gospel heritage for a mess of pottage. In Londonderry, there were 12 aldermen, of whom 10 were Presbyterians. Those 10 were turned out of office. Of the 24 burgesses of that city, 14 were Presbyterians, and they likewise were deposed. Some of these men were those who had fought in the siege of Derry for the preservation of the British crown just some 15 years earlier. In Belfast, of the 13 burgesses, 9 were Presbyterian, and they were evicted from office. And so it was all over the country. Presbyterian magistrates were turned off the bench, postmasters and postmistresses were removed from the post office, Presbyterian town councillors removed from their office. It was made punishable for a Presbyterian to even teach in a school. Landlords were encouraged to refuse them as tenants, or, if accepted, to charge them higher rents. Church lands had within their rental agreements the strictest clauses that no Presbyterian churches could be erected upon them or Presbyterian farmers lease them. Episcopalian penmen, such as Jonathan Swift, Dean of St. Patrick's Dublin, he of Gulliver Travels fame, poured forth their scorn upon this worthy people. It became difficult for Presbyterians to even meet for worship, and many were the legal difficulties set in their path. Two ministers, the Reverend James Fleming and the Reverend William Bigger, were sent to prison as a result of this opposition. In Belturbet, County Cavan, local Presbyterians set about erecting a new church building, and the presbytery of the area met to confer with them on this matter. The Episcopalian minister had the members of presbytery arrested on a charge of holding an unlawful and riotous assembly. Despite the absurdity of the charge, they were found guilty at the next Cavan Assizes. And to pacify their persecutors, they had to promise not to build a church within a mile of Belturbet. In Antrim, Downpatrick and Rathfryland, the doors of the Presbyterian churches were nailed up so that no services could be held. It was no fault of Episcopalianism in the days of Queen Anne that the gospel witness of the Presbyterian church was not eradicated from the land. Despite it all, Presbyterianism held its ground and indeed progressed. It comprised 140 congregations under 11 presbyteries at that time. In 1710, the Synod of Ulster formed a plan for the preaching of the gospel in the Irish tongue. Bibles, catechisms, and copies of the Confession of Faith were prepared in Irish for distribution. Despite their own troubles, Presbyterians had a burden for the souls of others, even those from that community which had so persistently opposed them, even unto death. George I came to the throne in 1714, and under his reign things improved somewhat for Presbyterians. In 1719, the Toleration Act was passed. Despite the stern opposition of the bishops, the act exempted Presbyterians from the penalties to which before they had been liable. However, the Test Act remained in power. As mentioned earlier, 11 had appeared within the ranks of Presbyterianism. In 1705, the Clerical Club was formed for the purpose of discussing theological topics. A leader amongst these clerics was the Reverend John Abernethy of Antrim. The club was called the Belfast Society. It grew to be influential, but it was an influence for evil. Its meetings became the fountainhead of erroneous doctrine. These doctrines soon were termed as New Light. As ever, when there arises New Light in opposition to the True Light, the new is soon revealed as the old darkness of the devil's lie. Isaiah the prophet stated the matter well, to the law and to the testimony. If they speak not according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. Isaiah chapter 8 and the verse 20. There was no light in the pronouncements of the Belfast Society whatsoever. In 1719, the Reverend Abernethy preached a sermon which was entitled Religious Obedience Founded on Personal Persuasion. It gave rise to a controversy which gripped the whole Presbyterian Church. It was really an attempt to stop the requirement that all must sign the Westminster Confession of Faith before being licensed as ministers for the Presbyterian Church. In 1720, an act was passed by the General Synod called the Pacific Act. It was an attempt to bring peace. It permitted those who had any scruples about signing the confession because of objections to certain parts or phrases to substitute their own wording. Like most compromises, it failed miserably. It became a door through which those of heretical views entered the pulpits of Presbyterianism. Under the compromise, the Reverend Samuel Halliday was installed in Belfast in July of that year, even though he altogether refused to sign the Confession of Faith in any form. Four members of the presbytery conducting the installation objected to it proceeding, but they were overruled. At a meeting of the sub-synod of Belfast in January 1721, the members of the presbytery who installed Halliday were publicly rebuked. After a debate which lasted from Tuesday until Friday at 4 a.m., the depths to which the malady had grown can be seen in the fact that the presbytery who installed Halliday refused the rebuke and refused likewise to sign the Confession of Faith. No steps were taken to deal with this rebellious attitude. At the annual General Synod, there were some 17 petitions asking that all members of the Synod subscribe the Westminster Confession of Faith as a confession of their faith. Happy for the Church had it accepted these petitions, but instead compromise again won the day. Now instead of subscription of the confession being mandatory, it became permissible. Thus apostasy enters and advances when no resolute action is taken to cut it out. One measure adopted to remedy the constant debates in the annual synod and bring about a degree of peace was the placing of all the non-subscribing ministers into one presbytery, the Presbytery of Antrim. This was decided in 1725. A year later, another decision of synod resulted in the refusing of any fellowship or communion with the Presbytery of Antrim. However, such a partial separation as this could never heal the church thus infected with error. It was to be another 100 years before a full and complete separation from the errors of Unitarianism was to be accomplished. Two other notable events took place in the 18th century. One was the rising tide of emigration of Ulster Presbyterians to the United States of America, where they became known as Ulster Scots. The Reverend Francis McKeamy went to America about 1681, and he proved to be the vanguard of a flood of fellow Presbyterians that reached its full tide after the first quarter of the 18th century. From about 1729, it is reckoned that 12,000 people annually left Ulster for the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. There awaited them there the Presbyterian Church, which Francis McKeamy had planted toward the close of the 1600s. It is claimed that a colony of Ulster men in Mecklenburg County in North Carolina had signed a Declaration of Independence in May 20th, 1775, before Thomas Jefferson produced it in writing in Philadelphia. They who had played such an important part in the development of Ulster were destined to play an important part in the development of the United States. Back in Ireland, it was no wonder that deadness ensued. The drain of godly people, plus the workings of the plague of falsehood and error, had to have its impact upon the spirituality of Ulster. Not surprisingly, the old spirit of rebellion and slaughter arose again amongst the Roman Catholic population. An alliance sprang up between Unitarianism and bloody revolution, which is boasted of still today by Irish Republicans such as Sinn Féin. Doubtless, the spirit of revolution in France stirred such thoughts and gave rise to the Society of United Irishmen. In 1798, insurrection broke out, and irrespective of the high-sounding ideals that many pontificated, it was soon clear that the murderous spirit of 1641 had awoken once again. Some Presbyterians, imbued with the doctrines of Unitarianism, sided with the rebels, and there were notable Unitarians amongst the leadership. The Reverend James Porter of Grey Abbey, an Arian, was executed for treason. The Reverend William Steele Dixon of Portaferry, also of the New Light Party, was imprisoned for 3 years at Fort George in Scotland. In all, only 8 ministers of the synod, which comprised about 200 ministers, were convicted of any complicity in the rebellion. The rebellion witnessed terrible atrocities against the Protestant people in the southwest of Ireland. The name of Father, and we insert inverted commas around that title, Murphy of Bullavogue, will ever live amongst the list of monsters of cruelty that Roman Catholicism has produced. Protestants were gathered together by this brutish priest and his followers to a camp that they had established at Vinegar Hill. Holy water was liberally sprinkled on those that engaged in the mass murder there. At a barn in Scullabogue, 184 Protestants, mostly old men, women and children, were driven into and imprisoned. One by one they were taken out and butchered. When this proved to be too slow a process, the barn was set on fire, and the remaining victims burned to death. It is recorded that a little child tried to escape the flames by crawling under the door, but a brute drove his pike into the child, and as a farmer would toss a sheaf of corn, the little one was pitched back into the flames. So another century, marked by persecution, error, deadness, immigration, and finally brutal rebellion, drew to a close in Ireland. The beginning of the 19th century brought a most welcome change in the spiritual condition of Ulster. The dreadful malady of Arianism persisted, and that was seen in 1810 when a Presbyterian minister boldly proclaimed himself to be a proponent of that wicked heresy. No action was taken by the synod, though 17 ministers protested against this tolerance of error by the synod and signed their names to the protest in its minutes. The protest was a harbinger of a coming battle which would rid the Presbyterian Church of the curse of this error. Another hopeful sign was an increasing interest in missionary outreach. A plea was made for the London Missionary Society and was heard at a meeting of the synod in Cookstown in 1812. Though it will surprise many of today's believers to learn that some leading ministers objected to the appeal on the grounds that attempts to win the heathen to Christ was absurd and visionary. However, other ministers supported the appeal strenuously, and the pulpits of the synod were opened to Dr. Waugh of London, who was pleading this cause of missionary endeavour. Presbyterian students, who up until this time had been trained in Glasgow, began to turn to a new educational institution established in Belfast, the Academical Institution. It was supported by the Presbyterian Church as well as the Seceders, who had come over to Ulster from Scotland in the mid-1700s. Their secession from the Church of Scotland arose over the reimposing of lay patronage in that church by an Act of Parliament. This Act restored a right to local aristocrats virtually to impose a man of their choice upon a congregation irrespective of the views of the members. By this means, the growing lobby of moderatism advanced their influence. The blight of moderatism was well defined by Thomas Chalmers, who was to become the great leader of the Free Church of Scotland. He depicted the period as the dark night of the Church of Scotland. He described a moderate sermon in this manner. A moderate sermon is like a winter's day, short, clear, and cold. The brevity is good, the clarity is better, but the coldness is fatal. And, said Chalmers, moonlight preaching ripens no harvest. The moderates abhorred religious enthusiasm. Instead, they craved popularity with the upper classes of society. They chose the church as their profession because it offered them security of position and a reasonable income, and some of them were not averse to acting on the stage. Ministers of this character began to be imposed under the new Parliamentary Act upon congregations who preferred men who preached the old gospel message. Things came to a head in 1732 when the famous Ebenezer Erskine preached a sermon before the Synod of Stirling in which he called for reform in the church. For this, he was deposed. Three ministers who stood with him in his protest were treated in the same manner. Thus began the Seceders' Witness in Scotland. These men loved the old gospel doctrines and were willing to suffer for them. At that time in Ulster, the error of Arianism and the shameful tolerance of error akin to Scotland's moderatism were on the rise. There were those in Ulster who looked to the Seceders for a remedy. The first Seceders' congregation came into being in Lisle Hill near Templepatrick in County Antrim in the mid-1740s. The witness of the Seceders grew, and their numbers increased, and their sharing in the running of the Belfast Academical Institution was an indication of their standing and influence. Two notable men were amongst those appointed as professors to this institution. The Presbyterian Church appointed the Reverend Samuel Hanna, and the Seceders appointed the Reverend Samuel Edgar. Sadly, despite the presence of these two good men, the institution became the centre of Arian influence, and that in turn led to the final conflict in the Synod of Ulster between Orthodoxy and Arianism, which resulted in the overthrowing of this evil malady and its banishment from the Presbyterian Church in that day. That battle took place in 1829 in Lurgan at a meeting of Synod. There, Arianism within the Presbyterian Church received its death blow at the hands of a truly great man, Henry Coke. But we will come back to that battle a little later. Let us first consider a little of the life of this man who played such a vital part in the history of the gospel in Ireland. Henry Coke was born on May 11th, 1788, in the townland of Grilla, near the town of Magheragh, County Londonderry. He was of humble farming stock and enjoyed a rather primitive early schooling, but he still was able to enter Glasgow College when he was 14 years old. In 1808 he graduated and was ordained as an assistant minister in Doneen, near Randallstown, County Antrim. In 1811 he accepted a call to Donegore, near Temple Patrick, and there remained for 7 years. He was a diligent pastor who also gave himself to the study of the theological issues of the day. He also gained a reputation as an orator of unusual power. In 1818, at the age of 30, he was called to Killyleagh on the County Down coast. He was there but 3 years when an English minister, the Reverend J. Smedhurst, was brought over by the New Light Party to help strengthen and revive its struggling cause, for it was feeling the impact of a growing evangelical spirit at that time. Smedhurst was brought to Killyleagh, and Henry Coke attended his meeting. At the end of the meeting, Coke invited the whole gathering to attend his church the following Sabbath, where, he said, he would refute every dogma Smedhurst had proclaimed. Naturally, the following Sabbath, a great multitude crowded into Henry Coke's church. There, Henry Coke tore to shreds the Arian arguments of Smedhurst. Furthermore, Coke announced that he planned to follow Smedhurst to every town and village where he planned to speak, and there again refute anything he said. So began a notable chase as Henry Coke doggedly pursued the apostle of Arianism around Ulster. In the end, the leaders of the New Light Party saw that Smedhurst's lectures were doing more harm to their cause than good, and so he was dispatched back to England, never to return. These events surrounding Smedhurst's lectures served to bring the Arian controversy right to the front of the minds of Christians in Ulster. For some 7 years, Henry Coke persisted at every annual meeting of the Synod to battle for the truth of God. In 1828, at a Synod meeting in Newry, County Down, Henry Coke raised the issue of the Arian influence being exerted in the Belfast academical institution. He was almost alone in his stand. How his position reflects the loneliness of God's men in former and subsequent ages. Standing for and with the Saviour has never been a popular cause. On that occasion, he is recorded as saying, "I seem to stand alone, yet I am not alone. Men may draw back in fear, but God and truth are with me." Soon he was proved right. The champion of Arianism at this time was Dr. Montgomery of Dunmurry, a village just outside Belfast. He was also head master of the English department in the Belfast Academical Institution. He was a most able public speaker and a formidable opponent. One of the confrontations between himself and Henry Cook took place at the Strabane Synod in 1827, had taken place on a motion moved by Henry Cook that every member of the Synod present should be called upon to state whether or not they believed the answer to the sixth question of the Shorter Catechism. How many persons are there in the Godhead? The answer given is, there are three persons in the Godhead, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one God, the same in substance, equal in power and glory. The debate that followed lasted from Thursday until Saturday, and during it, Henry Cook gave one of his most splendid speeches. He was ably supported by Dr. Stewart of Brasheen. Dr. Montgomery, the Arian advocate, gave a speech which was technically brilliant, but because it was theologically flawed, it was demolished by Cook and Stewart. The motion proposed by Henry Cook was carried overwhelmingly. Of those present, 117 ministers and 18 elders affirmed their belief in the Trinity. However, two ministers declared their disbelief and eight declined to answer. The following year, 1828, the issue came to a head. Henry Cook pushed for the establishment of a committee that would examine all candidates for the ministry with a view to excluding any who held to Arian or other unsound views. This resulted in another confrontation between Cook and Montgomery, but Cook's overtures were carried by a large majority, 139 for, with 57 against. The Arians within the Belfast Academical Institution knew they faced gradual extinction by virtue of the committee voted into existence by the Synod, so they prepared a remonstrance, protesting against the measure. This was to be presented to the next annual meeting of the Synod. This gathering was eagerly anticipated. It took place in Lurgan. Dr. Montgomery had many months to prepare for the meeting, and he spoke very powerfully for nearly 3 hours, displaying all the skills and arts of the orator. Indeed, his speech was so impressive that even the closest friends and supporters of Dr. Cook trembled for him, almost despairing of him being able to answer. After an adjournment of 30 minutes, and without any further opportunity to prepare a response to the many charges led against him, Dr. Cook stood to his feet and gave what is considered one of the greatest displays of oratory ever heard in Ireland. It heralded the death of Arianism within the Presbyterian Church in that day, and resulted in the withdrawal of the proponents of that evil doctrine from the Synod the following year. The final link in the chain which bound Irish Presbyterianism to orthodoxy took place in 1835, when it was proposed that subscription to the Westminster Confession of Faith become requisite for all licentiates, elders, and ministers. This law was confirmed in 1836. There can be no doubt that this work of purging, under the leadership of Dr. Henry Cook, became the precursor of the glorious 1859 revival that swept through Ulster, the glowing embers of which are still being experienced in this land today. The province of Ulster, with its strong Presbyterian presence, was shaken by the hand of God in a most wonderful way. The ingathering of souls was apostolic. It is reckoned that up to 100,000 souls came under the influence of divine grace in that day of blessing, most of whom became affiliated to the Presbyterian Church. The moral, civic, and above all, the spiritual life of the land was changed, and the remnants of that change still show in Ulster to this day. Despite the increasing efforts of ecumenism and Romanism within the once great Presbyterian Church, the Methodist, and the Episcopalian denominations over the last 50 years. The flame of the gospel still burns brightly in Ulster, though sadly on a lesser scale. May the God of 1859 enable it to continue burning, and increasingly so, until our blessed Saviour returns in glory. We must learn the lesson of the truth that is set forth in Hosea chapter 10 and the verse 12, a verse that has featured so many times in sermons in earlier years in Free Presbyterian pulpits. Sow to yourselves in righteousness, reap in mercy, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord till he come and rain righteousness upon you. I can well recall that verse being preached in a little mission hall in a side street at the lower end of the Newton Ards Road in Belfast in 1964. I was but a Christian for 6 months, and as Dr. Paisley preached on that text, I had a meeting with God, such as God's demand still for his people before they can enjoy the showers of blessing from his merciful hand. The old hymn states it well. There shall be showers of blessing if we but trust and obey. There shall be seasons refreshing if we let God have his way. Yieldedness to God and obedience to his word, these are the requirements set down by the Lord if we are to enjoy his grace and power amongst us again. God help us to learn that lesson, so wonderfully illustrated in those days of battle and conflict, faithfulness and victory amongst our forefathers in 19th century Ulster.
That was Reverend Ivan Foster. Next week, Lord willing, we will air the final installment of this series titled A History of Ireland as it relates to the Ulster Scots.